period of time, but pretty interested to see or to hear your thoughts of the business as it stands today, and probably more interested in what the opportunities ahead are. So, Jonathan, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Tim, and I appreciate the hosting of the session. Really appreciate it. So, I guess I'd start off with the purpose of the session today, really to introduce Richard and myself and give you a high-level overview and our impression, first impressions of the business. I've been with Infomedia now 80 days, and Richard's been with the business for 60 days. So typically we would do this type of briefing session at 100 days, but we've done it at 80 days for two reasons. A, because we can, and B, I think there's been a desire from the community to hear a bit more about what our impressions are. And also there's a blackout soon, so we thought this was the right time to do it. I would like to thank you for the patience that you've given us. There's been a lot of interest in the organisation, what we're doing and what we think, and you have given us the time to get across the business, so I do want to thank you for that patience. For those of you that don't know me, I'd like to introduce myself. I set up and ran, I was the founder of a business called Red Rock. We sold Red Rock to USC, and we built that really from scratch to a $150 million revenue business, 10 offices around the world. But I guess the one thing I'm proud of in my past career and the roles that I've done is that we've been able to grow, the team has been able to grow the business faster than the industry growth rate and certainly faster than our competitors. And hopefully some of the learning from that we can carry forward into the intermediate role. Maybe Richard, if you could introduce yourself.
Sure, thanks, Jonathan. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces. Those who don't know me, my name is Richard Leon. My background is coming from technology companies, my latest being CFO of Altium Limited, whom a lot of you already know. Altium joined ASX 200 last year, which is a great effort. Now, Infomedia and Altium has a lot of parallels. Infomedia, both companies have been around for quite a while. It's got great IP, it's got global presence, it's got a subscription model. A lot of the subscription revenue is coming outside of Australia. So there's a lot of similarities there. Now, Altium was by no means an overnight success. So it took a lot of hard work. But the way Altium achieved its results was focusing on the simple things, doing the simple things well, like customer centricity, fiscal discipline. Again, there's a lot of similarities here. When I left Altium, I took a bit of time off, a bit of hiatus to reconnect with my family because I spent a lot of time living on a Boeing. And now that I've had that hiatus, I'm re-energized, I'm reinvigorated to take on this challenge, because Infomedia to me is a potential realization story. It is a high growth story, and it comes with its own challenges. And quite frankly, when I talk to Jonathan, this is the reason why Jonathan and I joined, is to take on these challenges. We certainly didn't join to take on a cushy 9-to-5 job of maintaining a company. We want to drive the growth here. Anyway, enough of me. We should get right into the presentation.
Thanks, Richard. So what we'll do is we'll briefly run through the slide deck, and then we'll have questions after, if that's okay. So the agenda slide, I'd like to really just focus on who we are, the growth opportunity within the industry, and then talk about our short-term five-point plan. So if you just go to slide four. So I'm going to cover who we are, what we do, and where we do it. And if I can, for those that understand the business, please bear with me. Some of you don't understand or not that close to the business, so it's not an understanding. But I'd just like to give you a flavor of the business, and that will give you some context around some of the opportunities. So we provide software to the global auto industry. We've been established for a long time. And we have software in two parts of the business, the service part of the industry and the parts part of the industry. And I'm going to describe that software in a bit more detail. I guess the key story from our perspective is we are on a new journey, and that is a journey moving from what was a publishing business to a software as a service business. And with that journey from a founder-led business to a small, medium-type business, I believe has a lot of opportunities and some challenges. And I think that journey is really what we're going to talk about today, which is how we're moving from that publishing business to what is, I believe, a SaaS business. So if you move to slide five, we're a global organization supporting global customers. Now, I think that's important because the ability to sell to our global customers and implement regionally is important because I do think that gives us a competitive differentiator to a number of our competitors. And if I can give you an example, so if we take Kier as a customer, we have the ability to sell, and we have sold to Kier an end-to-end solution, and then we have the ability to translate that into multiple languages, and I don't know if it's 29, but they're probably close to 29 languages, and then execute and roll that out globally. And I think that we're one of the few organizations that can actually deliver those type of solutions globally. So what do we do? So on slide six, there might be what looks like a complicated slide, but what I'm going to try and explain a little bit about the customer segment and our product offering. So we have, on the left-hand side, there are the customers. So we have a relationship with the automakers, the global automakers. Now, those relationships, typically, we can sell directly to them, and in some scenarios, when we sell directly to the automakers, we will have what is often defined as a mandated agreement. So a mandated agreement is typically in Europe, in South America, and Canada. And then on the other side, we have what is effectively an endorsed relationship. So we become a preferred supplier. In the US, typically we become a preferred supplier, but we still then have to go and sell indirectly to the dealer channel. And we would sell to them the three key product offerings. And if you take MicroCat, that's our parts solution, and we have a couple of variants to that I've just simplified, but there are a couple of variants of the MicroCat product, and that's what is our traditional product. Then we have the SuperService Menu and SuperService Triage, and those are the two key software offerings within our service solution. So then if we have a mandated or an endorsed supplier relationship, we can then roll that out to the dealers. Now, those are the franchise dealers of the large automakers, and that's where the majority of our sales are currently happening. We also have a relationship then with the independent motor trade. So those are typically what we define as segments of the crash or mechanical. Funny enough, the size of the segments gets a lot bigger. So from the dealer channel to the crash to the automaker, they get significantly larger. And if I can just use a use case for you so you can understand how you might experience our software. When you drive your car into a dealership for a service, you take your car in, someone greets you and says, "Hello, Richard, welcome." The first thing is there is the interaction with the service organization. And our super service product typically kicks off from that point. We do have some products that allow you to book online before the service. That's our Connect product. But typically, that's the first relationship that you have with our software. We have two pieces of software within the service space. So the first one is our Super Service Triage, which is really managing the workflow process of an interaction with the service organization. And often integrated with that, but not always, and they are sold separately and together is the SuperService Menu product, and that is effectively a quoting product. So when you come in for your 10,000 kilometer service, when Jeremy brings his Maserati in for his 10,000 kilometer service, the scenario is, Jeremy, your 10,000 service is cost X amount, these are the parts you need, and this is the pricing our software calculate that based on best practice for that journey. So that's the service side. However, the other side is a card side, which is a Microsoft product. And that gives the, and typically they're two separate departments. So they are typically very separate. And in some scenarios, the parts in the large dealership or dealer groups, the parts is a completely separate P&L, where service would call up parts and say, how much is the windscreen wiper for X? And we have the software which gets the right part at the right price at the right time. Now, that might seem like a simple thing, which is, you know, everyone has a catalog, but we believe we have the market leading catalog which allows us to identify the right part by VIN very quickly. And getting the wrong part has a significant implication both to the service experience and to the and then to the profitability of the dealership. So the data, it's not only an efficiency opportunity, but it's also a critical profitability issue, and the data integrity is critical in the electronic part catalog. So that's effectively the two parts of our business. So if you go to the next slide, I just wanted to share with you the industry, a little bit about the industry. So that's slide 7. The global parts industry is a $1 trillion industry. It's actually evenly spread across the Americas, EMEA, and Asia, which happens to be where our three core offices are. And then if you cascade that down, there really are these three segments which I mentioned, which is the dealer, the crash, and the mechanical. To give you a sizing of just one of those segments, so the U.S. dealer service and parts segment for the dealer segment is about $91 billion U.S. dollars. So that's the size of the part and service segment. That is a critical part for the automaker. It's critical for a number of reasons. Part sales are critical to the automaker, and obviously the future sale of a car is directly related to the customer satisfaction of the existing car. So there's a correlation between how happy you are with the car and your likelihood to buy a new car. So there's no debate about the importance of this area for the global automaker. And we estimate that the industry growth rate in parts and service is high single-digit numbers. So what does this mean to us as an organization? So our year-on-year growth, this is on slide 8, is less than 5% per year. We estimate the industry growth rate to be high single digits. And really the question is, how do we drive our revenue growth to be at least in line with industry growth rate? Now, Richard and I did not join Infomedia to run a business which is at least in line with industry growth rate. Without a doubt, we have significantly high aspirations, but I think we need to crawl before we walk. And so what we've focused on is, what is our first step to drive the business? And we have a 5-point plan, which is how we're going to, in the short term, get our growth rates to industry growth rates. And then we have a concurrent plan, which is how do we amplify that growth. So if we focus on, today we're going to focus on what do we do today within the next 12 months to get our growth rates to what is industry growth rates. Concurrently, we're looking at how do we amplify that growth. So we'll focus on the first one, but I will mention the medium-term plan. So we believe there are opportunities in the medium term to look at, A, are there product opportunities to enhance our product today that we're not doing that can drive growth. And we have a bunch of those. Are there adjacencies to our existing product? So, for example, can we take some of the data that we have and monetize that and sell the data? And there are lots of adjacencies that we are exploring. And the third one is, from an M&A perspective, are there acquisition opportunities that we can pursue? And I look at the acquisition opportunities from two perspectives. One, it either gives us strength from a geographic perspective, or there's functional capability that we don't have that makes sense and we could acquire. So those are the medium-term opportunities. But today we're going to focus on the five-step plan, which is really what are we doing today to drive our growth. The final point is important, sorry, on that slide 9, which is we are in a great industry, we've got great employees, great customers, and we really feel we have the right assets, and with, I think, the right focus and leadership, we can really drive this this growth, and we really believe that growth needs to be there. So we'll talk about the five-point plan, and hopefully that gives you a feeling and some colour for our view of the business. So we believe that the five key areas that we need to focus on in the short term that will drive growth. So the first one is simplify the business. The second one is drive sales performance. The third one is prioritize our delivery effort. And then how do we align our culture to support that growth? And then the fifth one is how do we provide transparency to you, the investors? So if I then go through these 5 points, I'm going to go through the first four, and Richard will talk about the fifth one. So the business is actually a simple business, and over time it's got complicated. I think the causality of that complication really is we've got regional businesses that have taken on some of what I think should be a centralized function. So what we are doing is we're centralizing, and much of this is pretty obvious, we're centralizing support functions. So marketing, HR, finance, sales process, we're getting consistency in those support functions. This will lead to efficiency gains. We are using enterprise software, and we're rolling out new ERP and CRM applications in the next 2 months. And these will, again, support the standardized processes. These processes will give us some scalability and some efficiency. But the other key issue which is dear to both Richard and my heart is you get what you measure. And if it's complex, you don't know what you're measuring. And I think defining what success is and working out what we need to do and how we're going to grow is key. And so we are making sure that the clarity of what that success is embedded in everything we do. And I'll talk, and Richard will talk a little bit more about that. So then let's talk about driving sales performance. So we've been very clear around, and we've reprioritized our focus around the two markets, which is task and service. If I can just zoom into this a little bit. So we have our task offering, which is our MicroCatch product. It is a mature market. We have an extremely strong product. I believe that we have underperformed in the growth in this area, and I think that there is additional growth in this area without a doubt. Then if I move into the service market, it is a fragmented market. We have a competitive differentiated offering. Triage together with menus, I believe, is a winning offering, and we feel there are growth opportunities. Just to give you a view of how I see the sales model working, if you take up three regions as verticals, so you take Asia, EMEA, and the Americas, and you take up three product offerings, being MicroCatch, Super Service Triage, and Super Service Menu, you effectively get a 3x3 grid. And to me, I look at that 3x3 grid and then try and understand for each product offering within each region, what is a competitive differentiated offering, and it is different by region. We sell, and the maturity of competitors in each of those areas, in each of the regions, are quite different. So we are looking at each of those products by each of the regions. We then identify what differentiates ourselves. That then cascades down to clear marketing and execution sales, aligning our marketing campaigns to our sales exercise, and we will drive growth through that. We're in the process of doing that right now, so we have our sales strategy planning process happening right now, and that is very much around getting clarity around that 3x3 matrix, and then working out using enterprise sales processes and techniques to drive sales in our organization. I think even within the last 80 days, we've seen some returns in the sophistication and the maturity of our sales process and working at how to win and close in those markets. I feel like we have a good pipe, and hopefully we'll have some good news to share with you in the near future. The final point is also it's about the customer, and I feel like our sales organisation and some of our product management teams have actually been slightly removed from the customer, and so being able to prioritise and align ourselves to the customer. So we've really got the whole organisation much closer to the customer, and I can explain that maybe in the next slide, which is around delivery. So what we have done on the delivery side is we've restructured our delivery organisation to be much more aligned to the customer. So we now have customer delivery managers that focus on our customer outcomes, and that is key to prioritising and aligning the delivery objectives of our customers with the sales team, and that actually has been a good time. The second one is the delivery has been a constraint on our sales, and the offshoring does two things. A, it gives us scalability, so we can scale up and scale down as we need. We have also been able to prioritize and focus on those areas that are A, important to our customers, and B, aligned to our sales objectives. And we've had a key prioritization focus, and then we've been able to turn on the tap. It has taken longer on the offshoring. The reality is we've had to scale up and skill up that team, but I feel as of now we've got a good organization. We have now 44 people offshore, and the majority are now operational and working and successful. It has taken us longer to skill them up appropriately. Again, then, from a delivery perspective, simplistically, we need to have an agile organization that delivers the right product, but also with the right quality. And I think we've put in a bunch of processes. We've put a governance structure across the whole organization. We've got a delivery head of delivery that is focused on a Prince 2 methodological approach, just to ensure that what we deliver, we're tracking very clearly what we deliver and the quality processes. And as a result, we will have our Super Service version 2 out in July, and that again will unlock revenue opportunities. So the fourth one is aligning the culture to the growth objective. Now this could seem like a motherhood statement or a try. Everyone else is going to talk about culture. I absolutely believe that this is core to our business. We were a publishing business, and we are moving to a SaaS business. There are significant differences in the business model, the responsiveness, the complexity of the sale, and the complexity of the rollout. And I think we have an extremely willing, motivated, and capable employee base, but understanding what is success and aligning our incentive structure to that growth and success, I think, is key, and we're in the process of realigning all our KPI and comp plans and defining clearly and celebrating success in the organisation. And I think also as we grow and we become this organisation, having an organisation that has the right accountability and autonomy to make those decisions, to make mistakes, to grow, is important. And to test constantly, becoming a much more agile organisation. So we are doing that. We've got a big exercise in that space around our people and culture. And then finally, we are moving to a new campus in Belrose, and I think that will be a great step, just to have a physical environment which is cool, which is aligned to what our culture is. So on that note, I'd like to hand over to Richard. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. So before we move to page slide 16, I just want to echo again Jonathan's sentiment of appreciation for this group to be patient and allowing us time to understand the business. We're also very thankful for the feedback that we've received, often direct, often constructive criticism, which again we welcome because it helps us build this foundation for open communication. Now, we are committed to this. And hopefully this will be the first of many where we continue along our journey. So on this journey we have Tanya, many of you have met or have engaged with. Tanya is a great asset for us in this organisation. She will be a great resource for you to be the first point of contact. And why do I know this? If I can paint you a picture of Tanya's humble office. In her office, she has papers scattered everywhere, mostly analyst reports. She has her desk phone to her right, and she has multiple smartphones on her desk. So I'm pretty sure that she will provide prompt response. So on page 16, Jonathan has already talked about simplification. It's quite logical. He also talks about aligning accountability with sales growth. What I want to talk about is our monthly recurring revenue. Now, again, feedback from the market was talking about why we started off, or why the company started off by talking about subscription numbers and why it's moved to MRR. And hopefully this section will help demystify that. So for us, MRR is the most meaningful measure by far. We are of the opinion that subscription count is overly simplistic and has caused confusion. To give you a sense of this, we have a number of ways we go to market. So I'll use two examples of how we sell or how our customers can buy. And this hopefully will exemplify this point why subscription numbers is not the best measurement. So one way of going to market is to sell by license. Very clear. Very similar to a lot of SaaS models. So we might have a dealer, they might want to buy 10 licenses. We can track that. We can track whether they expand because they're growing, whether they contract because they're closing down their business a little bit. We can track their churn very, very easy. The other way we go to market is we sell what's known in the industry as rooftop sales. So these rooftop sales usually apply to larger dealers. They have a lot of mechanics. They may run a number of shifts. And so what they would like is to say, for example, a usage model of up to X. So it could be up to 50 licenses or up to 99 licenses. And, of course, we price accordingly to it. Now, tracking that for us at this juncture doesn't make a lot of sense if someone on a up to 99 is using 99, using 80, or using 70. What we are concerned with right now is that they renew and they continue to pay that recurring revenue up to the 99. So hopefully that gives you a better sense that if we blended these two together and use subscription count as a measure, it will cause confusion. And that's why we are focusing on the most meaningful measure for us, which is MRR. On to page 17, this is how Jonathan and I, in our short time having our feet on the desk, see the business. I appreciate there's a wide audience here, so some of these many of you may know, and some of these might be useful for those who are new to the organisation. So fundamentally, the foundation is underpinned by great IP. We have a global presence and a large, very loyal customer base. So we see our business as three intrinsically linked zones. The first one being contract wins. Now, we win many contracts. We win small contracts, medium contracts, and large contracts. And if those large contracts are material, we will communicate that to you. We win these contracts because we have strong relationships with the global automakers that have been developed over many years, and they acknowledge that Intermedia has a deep understanding of the auto industry. Now, this next piece may not have been clear, so allow me to tell this story. When we win a contract, what it really represents is a right to sell or a right to participate. It doesn't actually mean revenue straight away. So we have two main types of contracts. One, which is the best for us, is a mandated sale. In this scenario, a franchise would say, we like your product, we are going to mandate that this gets rolled out to all our dealers. That's an awesome model for us. The other model is an endorsement model, where the franchise may say, we like your product, we'll endorse it, so we'll promote it amongst our dealers, but we'll also endorse one or two other competitive products to provide some sort of a competitive landscape for us. So it's not a wide competitive landscape, it's a narrow competitive landscape. We feel strongly, as Jonathan alluded to before, about the strength of our data, being a differentiator, that if we can execute well, we have a competitive edge against the other competitors in this endorsed contract thing. Now there are some, because of territorial laws like Australia, where there is a legal constraint of trade, where they call it endorsement because they can't actually force the dealer to use. But in those scenarios, these automakers, they actually put their own people, their own investment, as internal champions to push out our products. They also use their channel support to help us roll it out. Now, the significance of this part is the acknowledgement that there is a lag time between a contract win to our first invoice for the monthly recurring revenue. And the lag time is very dependent on which particular solution they buy. So, for example, if they want to buy our menu solution, we actually need to do menu development for them. And depending on the complexity, it could take a number of months. That's a good thing because it does make it sticky. But there is that lag. Other areas of lag could be integration to their ERP system, the dealer's ERP, which is called Dealer Management System, DMS, which you may hear the acronym a bit. And that may take a bit of time, but as we branch out, we will have more and more of these integrations, so we feel we could scale on that side. There are also externalities that may increase the lag time. Some of these could be the dealers have a very limited window for which they can do the rollout of the implementation. The other one could be they insist on having a number of pilot sites. The pilot sites are good because the automakers say, we want a pilot site to then prove to the larger dealers that this is the solution that we should go out with. So we see pilot sites as a positive. So again, this is really to say that that there is a lag time between a contract win and the first invoice. So the next part of this zone is MRR. And there's a reason why this is in the middle of the page, because this is where it all happens. This is where the whole organization converges on this. As Jonathan says, we're simplifying the organization structure. Everyone is focused on this number. And what we will be talking about on a regular basis will be net new MRR. So we'll be talking about how many dealers, well, maybe not how many dealers, but the net new MRR formula is as simple as you start off with a run rate, you add on dealers, new business, new dealers, you add on existing install base that may have expanded or may have even started to buy other offerings. So we may have a dealer that is using our part and they like our menus offering and they buy the menu solution. And then the negatives or the takeaways would be contraction, and this could be their own business reason, and the worst one being churn, where they actually drop off and don't use it. Unfortunately, so far, in my 60-day view, churn is quite low, which we will report on as we go further down the track. So everyone's focusing on MRR, and then this leads to NPAT, and we want NPAT to grow. I think we already shared with you in our last release that Jonathan and I feel that our run rate and our cost base is cost base that we feel comfortable with leading into FY17. This cost base is really geared into unlocking a lot of these contract wins that are building up leading into the MRR revenue. Will we add to it? The answer is yes. Will it be a step change? The answer is probably no. The takeaway here is that whatever investment we will consider to drive the growth that we joined this company for will not outpace the rate of growth in our revenue. That is very key. And by doing that, that will allow us to expand our margins over the years. As far as other expenses, I'll simply apply what I call the value discipline, which is basically we look at all our spend. If the spend isn't going to help us where we're going to, we won't spend it. If we feel that the spend is going to help us get to where we want to, we will hold that team project to account for a ROI that suits the company. And the last one is to reduce our exposure to non-operating items. And quite frankly, this is hedging. So right now we're reviewing it to review the change in policy. You know, our view is it's non-core. It isn't going to help us achieve the growth that we want. Should we minimize exposure? Yes. Should we be aggressive and maximize the return on it? No. So we are reviewing this, and we have a short-term plan. We've actually engaged an actuary consultant who specializes in this field, who's built and building us a stochastic modeling tool that could help us evaluate how much to hedge or whether to hedge at all. And then in my view, in the medium term, and as Jonathan and I look at the organizational structure, as we continue to support the regional growth, we may actually redeploy resources so that the outcome is that we create some sort of a natural hedge. Going on to the final page, I won't spend too much time on this. This is where the good stuff is. So on the orange line down the bottom we just talked about, that is our organic growth. That is what we're focusing on in the short term. Jonathan already talked about how we amplify the growth. And the only thing I will say here is that we will focus on the near-term priorities, but we'll also be very open to opportunities as and when they present themselves. So in summary for me, it's a exciting time for the business. Now, aside from our IP and everything else we said, we have a very healthy recurring revenue base that enviably already covers our cost base. We have a strong balance sheet that we can leverage off, and we have a great bunch of people that when you look in their eyes, they have a spirit of unfinished business. So everyone's really focused behind this. Jonathan and I believe the growth opportunities out there, the challenge, as in all businesses, is to execute. But these areas that I just spoke about, we will be reporting these to you regularly. So at our half year, at our full year, and any other engagements, we will be reporting on these metrics. So at this point, I'd like to hand it back to Jonathan.
Thanks, Richard. So if I can just summarise on slide 19, which is we have a five-point plan, which is to get our business to be delivering growth at least the industry growth rate. That's within the next 12 months. We then have a medium-term plan, which is really why we're here. We're here to drive growth steadily above industry and our competitive growth rate, and that's our challenge. And we feel that there's a great opportunity. We've got great organisation, great people, great product, and a great industry that we're working in. And so we are going to have fun doing this, without a doubt. And we are absolutely going to do our best to come back to you with great results. But I do want to thank you for all your time, and we might open for questions in the room here, if that's okay. And we do have some people online, so let's just take a couple of questions in the room.
US is kind of an opportunity that the market's been quite excited about in the past. I guess experience, as you mentioned, some delays.
Yeah.
Are you able to provide some sort of update as to how the opportunity looks today?
Yeah.
How you guys are tracking in terms of a run rate. We were previously told like 7 dealerships per month capability, ramping up to 20 per month. We were told previously that 80% of the potential volume of dealerships were bottlenecked through the integration of the DMS platforms from Reynolds and ADP. But maybe if you could just give us some sort of update in terms of, you know, integration with the DMSs. Presumably that's part of where you've invested in terms of new salespeople, and just maybe where it's standing today and where you think it's got the opportunity to be.
Thanks, and that's a great question. So let me break it down. So first of all, there have been headwinds in the US. The DMS integration, 80% of the big DMS integration is between Reynolds and Reynolds and CDK. We have completed the CDK integration, and that has been a big area of focus. And the Reynolds and Reynolds integration has been completed. It's in their testing window, and that is outside our control. We need to get that certified. We believe that should happen soon, as in weeks, but we're waiting for that. There is a lag then. As soon as those are done, and we have a planned rollout for, so there's actually a backup of customers that have signed and sold and waiting for the rollout. we have a backlog of those customers that we intend to roll out quickly in the US. In terms of those numbers that you mentioned, I would say that those are pretty spot on in terms of roughly my view of where we're at and where we could get to quite easily. So on Hyundai, that is the that was the headwind was primarily the DMS integration, and that took a lot longer than we forecast. There was a big focus over the last 80 days on getting that done and redeploying resources to ensure that, and it was a no-brainer. We've got customers waiting for the product. And then in terms of the US as the market, I think what we've learned is that we are in the process of learning about how we sell in this model from a door-to-door perspective. And we've ramped up the sales team, and I think the key issue is the sales team have been there, but we haven't been able to sell some of the product because, and in fact we've sold and haven't been able to deliver because of some of the integration issues. I would suggest that next year there will be significantly more revenue coming out of the US and much more sales based on both the DMS integration and also we have ranked up the sales team. It is, and we are still learning about that cadence from sale to, and there is actually from a sale, then there's actually a survey that we need to do which makes sure that the dealer has all the right equipment in before we can implement. Now, we've also been focused concurrently on shortening that period from sale to implementation, and it's literally dropped from 45 days to now less than 25, and we're looking at dropping that to 15 days, so from sale to start up the implementation. We can't implement unless the DMS integration is done, and as I said, CDK is done, and Reynolds is currently in certification with them.
You mentioned before you're changing the track line.
Yeah.
Going forward from what they were historically.
Yeah.
Can I open up that why Richard was sort of alluding to this little bit of measuring issues? So, can I ask, talk a little bit about how the sales force were incentivized and now how they were incentivized to be better for the being made to change?
Yeah. It's more, so the sales force is similarly incentivized, go and sell now, because they need to sell. The question really is at a senior management, it really is more around as Richard's era, which is MRR and NPAT is all we care about. And those two, so if your MRR is growing but you're not getting profit, or if you're getting profit, but we want both because as a business MRR is key. You can make profit doing consulting, but that's not our core business, does that make sense? So we've aligned our whole leadership team and all and the cascade from MRR and growth right through the organization. At a sales level, we are reviewing, but really at a sales level, it's more around consistency. So that's a consistent complaint in the US is the same in EMEA versus Asia, and that just getting consistency is a scale of risk. But at an MRR and KPI perspective, it's really tracking and measuring that daily. And Richard, if you want to?
Yeah, it's also a global bent on this. And Jonathan, maybe you might share with Karen and the team here where our regional heads were last week.
Yeah. I mentioned getting closer to the customer as an example. And for the first time, so we had all our regional leads in Korea with one of our big automakers talking about, as an organization, not as a region, but how are we going, and their question is how do we roll out quicker through the world. And we spent 2 days in Korea working with them and all their regional leads an action plan to drive growth quickly. So it wasn't about it really was about how do we speed up that rollout. And for the first time, I think we've had this global account management process. So we have a global account manager which looks at how do we drive growth for our customers, whilst previously being at a regional level. Okay.
ask those questions, Nick Burgess from Bayou. Just in the presentation, slide 12, you said the parks business requires some renewed investment.
Sure.
Give more detail on what that is.
So, the parks business, I think, is a big opportunity for us. And it requires investment, I would say, initially primarily at a sales level. So, at a sales level, I think we've taken our eye off the ball and we've been focused on the service side, which has growth opportunity, but and has real growth opportunity, but at the moment 75% of our revenues are in the park space. But primarily in that area. I do think that there is other opportunity around product enhancement that that gives us an opportunity to potentially disrupt in that industry, and we're exploring some areas around that. That's probably more medium-term play. But certainly right now, if you ask me where the investment is, we've got a disproportional focus on the service, which has growth opportunity, but I think even in the past space, we're not maintaining our share, which we should.
Just a second question. You mentioned that the business has been growing at sort of organic growth rate below the industry.
Yes.
And obviously in guidance from last week, you sort of said you're growing at 12%.
Yes.
Currency flavors up there.
Yes.
But perhaps a little bit more flavor around the 12%, what's been growing well and what hasn't in terms of the second half particularly.
Sure. So again, currency is a big play in that. And so, look, at the moment, I think our part business has been pretty flat. So if you took the growth on the whole, it's been pretty flat. Again, if you took it, the proportion of revenue versus sales effort in the part, it's probably 85% around service and 15% in the part. But disproportionate relative to the revenue. In terms of the sales growth, it's without a doubt within service. And in all regions, I think we're getting good service growth. We have been, that growth hasn't been good enough relative to, I think, the opportunity, simply because we've had some delivery opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. But across region, if you look at our year-on-year growth in the service space, it has been quite significant. Again, off a low base, I think the question is how do you ramp that up to be much more significant for us? So region by region, it's been quite similar, actually, in reality. I think EMEA actually has a slightly stronger growth. They've also, because they lost the JLR contract, they've actually more than made up the JLR loss, and this was on the service side, not on the EBC side, in the period. So their actual, if you normalise for the JLR loss, they probably grew more than everywhere else, and that's a large region.
And just related to that, you know, the company previously talked a lot about pilot activity, quite the number of pilots.
Yeah.
I mean, your assessment of the level of the number of pilots that are out there, pilot programs, are they increasing? Are they relatively stable? How many are you converting?
We haven't lost any pilots to date. It is really, so we do pilot, and the pilot is really just two things. The automaker asks us typically to pilot to use it as a marketing exercise within a region. So you'd have, so often in Europe, I'll give an example, you have something called a dealer council. So if you're in Germany or France, there's a council, and we get the support from the dealer council, and then they use it as a marketing exercise to say, look at dealership X, they've implemented our super service suite, and the net return is part sales have gone up by X, so they call that an RO uplift, a repair order uplift, and the quality and the customer satisfaction has gone up. It, of course, slows down the rollout. You'd rather them go, please roll it out to everyone and you don't have to try it. To answer your question, I think the pilot process is an important process, and I think we might be able to simplify and streamline that process. It has delayed some rollout. I suggest that the conversion from pilot to a sales, we can streamline that process. I think it's necessary and we have no option but to do it. To date, I'm not aware of any pilots that we've done that haven't led to sales. What's happened is that the whole process has taken longer for various reasons. It is, you know, my view is that's our job. And our job is we have to work out how to do that. I don't see that as a it really has delayed the revenue. In most scenarios, the pilots have been extremely successful. But what's happened is you'd have a customer saying, okay, if you have three pilots, could you please do three? Okay, those are great. Now, could you do nine? And no, those are great. And we've just gone, well, listen, there's a point where that's just enough. And I think generally they're using it as a marketing process to their dealers to get other dealers to come on. I'm pretty happy with the process. We do need to review how we manage and maybe more of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With the mid-tier electric ones, I guess there'll be less demand for parts and service.
Yeah. So the question is, given the demand for electric cars, will there be less demand? So will the growth potentially in the parts and service space?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the long term thing, but...
So I think it's a great question. The industry is being disrupted today without a doubt. I'd suggest that the impact of the... So I do think we are seeing a reduction and, in fact, a change in how customers service a car. So if we take the total, if you look at a car 10 years ago versus a car today, you'll find that the service cost is dramatically less. Dramatically less. You'd also look at the 10 years ago, the sophistication of a mechanic was quite different to one today. So 10 years ago, they would actually take things apart and rebuild them. Today, they just replace. So without a doubt, the industry is changing. To answer the question, I think we'd like to be a disruptor in the industry. And we've got a bunch of areas and ideas that, as a medium or longer term play, if you took a horizon 2 or 3, could play into that disruption. I think that customers and dealers will always have power, and they will always have to service cars. But I think what we are seeing is the insight and the communication between the car and the dealer is actually happening today. So we currently are building some software for one of our automakers where the car flags and ships over all the items that need to be repaired, and we're building that today into one of the automakers. And so when you arrive at the dealer, they go, okay, well, Jonathan, you need new XYZ. So that's happening, and we're building that today. I'd suggest that this is absolutely not a static industry. Things are absolutely going to change, and that to me is the biggest opportunity we have. I think the change will be slower in some scenarios. But if we don't have if we're not looking at a medium term around how the industry is changing, we won't have a business in 7 years. So I'm not sure I've answered the question, but we're definitely thinking about it. We are doing some things where certainly if you look at some of those segments, we are looking at playing in some of those other segments in the crash and mechanical, which are broader segments. We are looking at some offerings which allow us to cascade into some other areas that might allow, but those are medium-term places.
Do you have an incentive plan in place for your vision in terms of shares or options?
Yes. If you go, that when I believe that is online.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jonathan, can you just talk a little bit about your observations on the relationship with manufacturers today within the organisation, whether there's a view around whether any of those relationships are more under threat than others, as the Jaguar Land Rover has indicated.
Yeah.
And then I guess observations on opportunities with new manufacturers who are currently not able. When you can talk about that on a regional basis.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Ben. So, I think the relationship, from what I can, I was at the NADA conference in the US, which is the North American Dealers Association, and then I went to a road trip to Detroit and to to Cambridge and met a bunch of our the automakers. I don't think the relationship at the moment is actually changing that much. I think, if anything, the automakers are getting clear this is becoming a more and more important part of their business. So the service and parts space is more important, and they certainly are looking at how we can work with them more effectively. I think the interesting, I mean, if I look at an industry play, what I am seeing is the DMS providers are becoming less relevant to the automakers. So more of, and I think there is a disruption happening right now in the DMS world. If I can use a simile or parallel, it's a bit similar to the ERP world of corporate, where the old SAP and Oracle and Microsoft were critical, and now what you're finding is that the Salesforce, Workday offerings are becoming more important, those that are more customer related or employee directly employer related. So I'm actually seeing a bit of that shift, and hopefully we are on the Workday Salesforce side, if you want, in my parallel example. But I'm seeing that shift in the relationship, and then in terms of our relationship with some of the other automakers, to answer your second point, I think there is a big market. There are lots of relationships that we haven't that we should and will be pursuing, and there is an opportunity for us to extend that relationship without a doubt. And certainly if you look at a relationship with an automaker where we might have a good relationship in Australia or in Asia, and we haven't leveraged that out to US or EMEA, so we're seeing that as a big opportunity. And as we drive more global relationships, their organizations are typically quite fragmented also, but they clearly are buying both in a decentralized and centralized manner, and I think our global organization suits that, which allows us to sell at a regional level and also sell centrally, if that makes sense. And again, I hope to be able to announce some good wins in the future around some new global organization. If we want to take any calls, if there's anyone online, we haven't heard from anyone yet, but if anyone has any calls on the queue, that would be great.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask an audio question, please key *1 on your phone, followed by the pound key. Please make sure you unmute yourself to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question or your question has already been registered, please key *2. Questions will be taken in the order received, and we'll pause for a brief moment to compile a list of questions. Please key *1 to begin.
Good, thank you.
Maybe if I can just throw one last one in on my side. Fair to say a fairly substantial uplift in terms of the cost base in FY16. I don't know, maybe for Richard, if you're able to give us a little bit more colour in terms of the areas that there's been increased spend, there's been restructuring, there's been hedging losses, that are one-off, there's been spend on product development. How should we look at that spend on product development? Is that a lot of the spend going into just making sure that you're retaining the customer base? Does that provide an opportunity to extract more revenue out of the customer base? And maybe just some colour in terms of the sale, where you're deploying new people, and give us a bit of a sense of what the sales force looked like before and what it looks like now.
Sure. So maybe I can address this in this way, because we want to look forward, we want to move on from here. So the feedback that we've been receiving was that, you know, the announcement around this 2.5 million impact additional. Now, the challenge for Jonathan and I is just it's hard to make comments on things that we've discussed that we're not privy to. The feedback that I got was we need to be clearer and more consistent in our delivery, and I can see why, because the message was that we would maintain our revenue growth rate at a certain range, we would maintain a NPAT margin at either the June or the December half, and we will also add another 2.5. I mean, this kind of reminds me of a discussion I had with my builder, and the builder was saying, mate, there's three variables. You can either have cost, quality, or time. If you want good quality and low time, it's going to cost you. So in my mind, I'm thinking it's a kind of an awkward scenario, and it's difficult for us to comment on it. What I will say, is, with the hope of closing this subject and moving on, is that, yes, there were restructuring costs. And those restructuring costs in FY16 were incurred in the first half and in the second half. The sum total is circa 900,000, maybe a little bit more. There was also an acceleration of our investment that Tim was talking about. We started that in the first half and we continued that into the second half. The sum total of that spend for FY16, knowing that it's not reflected over annualised amount, is about $3.5 million. Where did that go to? We took on about a dozen people in the sales and support function. Many of those were in the US. A lot of them we took on in the first half, and a smaller portion we took on in the second half. The other side is in the development. And as Jonathan said, we ramped up on the outsource model up to 44. So we have locations in both Indonesia and the Philippines. If my memory serves me correct, in the first half, we started with 6 outsourced and then we ramped up to a current 44. What they're focusing on, they're focusing on unlocking the contract wins that we have won to convert them into MRR as soon as possible. And in fact, Jonathan's been quite humble, and on his first day, he initiated a project to really focus on that, and it's actually paying dividends. The takeaway here is notwithstanding these restructuring costs, which we hope that we don't see again, and we will do everything in our power to avoid that, is that the annualized cost of this accelerated investment in both sales and development will now make up this run rate that we're talking about. So going to FY17, the run rate that we've incurred for FY16 is the base from which we will launch. But Tim, hopefully that clarifies.
Great, thanks, Richard.
I'm just conscious of time. Are there any last questions in the room? Any last questions on the phone?
Yes, your first question comes from the line of
Adam Deliverdi.
Please proceed.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. Just a quick one. It's been quite a delay in getting to market, particularly in the US, and I just wanted an assessment on whether you thought the opportunity in the US now, and in MEA as well, is it now a conquest, or are you still seeing greenfield opportunities where you're converting paper to software? And then I know you made some comments about the DMS, but, you know, what's the go-to-market if not through the DMSs in those markets?
So if I can just conquest, can you explain that first part? At the moment, I think the US is a big opportunity. We still have the same relationships and we are winning more. Is the question, I don't think it's any different. So I'm slightly confused about that, the first part of the question. Can you explain it a bit more?
Sure. So I guess from outside looking in, you had some pretty sharp software, looked like you were first to market, and it feels like maybe over the last couple of years some competitors and even the DMSs have created staple products of a similar nature, and everyone seems to have like an end-to-end suite. So in as you look to penetrate the US, are you looking to displace existing deployments, or is there still like a paper-based contingent of, say, Hyundai dealers that you're trying to get into the 21st century?
I think it's a combination, without a doubt. A lot of, we have a bunch of opportunities which are still paper-based, but they don't use a, so I think what Adam's talking about is typically, if we took a service process, someone would be writing it down and they have no technology and no workflow process, and then us using triage and or menus would automate that. Now, getting back to your question, I think triage and menus, I don't think there are any organizations. I think we have an unbeatable product. And from what I can see, I might be slightly subjective, but I do feel it's a great product and highly competitive. I think the addressable market is significant, so both from customers that are on paper and from customers that might have a competitive product. I think we're doing both, and I think that is a significant market space for us still, and I'd say it will be for the next 3 or 4 years. It certainly isn't saturated. We certainly haven't touched the side of that. And then, can you repeat the second? I'm getting old. Can you repeat the second question? I've forgotten.
Just in terms of the go-to-market, I'm just thinking about the deployments that the dealers already have there. You know, who are you having in muscle out? I've noticed in Australia, Reynolds and Reynolds have done a fair bit of work with their own EPC-style products and getting terminals. So I'm just trying to figure out how mature is the market, and you know, who from a competitive set are you bumping up against as you're trying to make these sales?
It's different in Australia, and I think it's different by product, as I said. So I think we have, if I go back to the 3x3 matrix, if I look in Australia, I don't think we're coming up against Reynolds and Reynolds in any EPC. In the US, the DMS providers are absolutely, so they are acquiring to get into the space we are in. So there's absolutely been a bit of a roll-up play in that space. I do think, and I don't want to simplify because it's a good question, I do think that our competitive profile is different in Europe, and also our sales process is different when it's a mandated sale. But if I can, if I separate the two, I think the EPC, there's fewer opportunities, but they are big, and we have a very strong product, and we need to win every single one that we go after in that EPC space. There, in the service space, I think, for example, in Asia, we're selling triage by itself. So people are buying triage, and it's not necessarily integrated into the menu product, and we're getting lots of good wins in that space. In the US, typically, we're selling it as a bundle, so it's triage and menus. Again, I think we've got a competitive offering. The DMS, they are getting into that space. I think the competitive nature of our offering, again, is different, and we have some, I think we aren't winning our fair share of opportunities, and I think we have heaps of opportunity to grow more than we are. But I think it does get back to a sophisticated evaluation of what we're going to sell to whom and why would someone buy in each one of those sales in our matrix.
Okay, thanks. And just quickly, launch of menus version 2, is it implicit that there's going to be a price rise on that, or is there going to be additional functionality? I'm just thinking in terms of like a pure SaaS product, do you upgrade the whole existing installed base, or do you force them to pay to get the new version?
It depends. So some of our customers, depending on what we've contracted already, so some customers, but certainly the V2 of menus is typically the customer would pay the same price. We do have some added functionality which we believe in our menus product is market leading, and we are looking at rolling that out, which is completely new functionality. Which we believe we have, we are the only organization that actually has some of this functionality, and it's quite sophisticated functionality that we are currently building. That would be it would be effectively a completely new product, and that would be a different price model. So again, some customers have a contract, but when it's a new product, then you have the ability to price it differently. If it's a some, if it's just an upgrade, then they get those typically as part of their existing price. So to answer your question, on V2 for menus, what V2 for menus does is it is integrated with V2 for triage, and that has lots of new functionality in triage. It's got tablets, it's got a whole, it's got all mobile device, and it's got a whole lot of other functionality, and that just replaces V1, and so the new pricing for that is the same.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Any other? Good. Thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate that.